This is VOCM News Talk. Call 709-273-5211 or 1-888-590-8626. The views and opinions of this program are not necessarily those of this station. Here's VOCM News Talk host Linda Swain.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, on this crisp and cool and bright and beautiful Monday afternoon. Is it still only Monday? It is. We're told, or there are hints, heavy hints, that we're going to get some weather coming a little later on in the week, but we'll keep you apprised of that if and when that comes to fruition. Well, the big discussion today on the opening of the first day of the spring session of the House of Assembly was the $35 million paid to a single agency over a five-month period for the use of travel nurses here in Newfoundland and Labrador. Opposition leader Tony Wakeham wanted to know what government knew and when, and whether the Minister of Health signed off on the contract. Here's how some of that debate went.
Speaker, on January 12th, 2022, Liberal lobbyist Jordan O'Brien reached out to an aide in the Premier's office to introduce a company called Canadian Health Labs, which led to a $36 million in spending over 5 months for travel nurses. I asked the Premier, when did your office or you authorize this sole contract to be awarded to this particular Canadian Health Labs company?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member opposite for the question. It begs an important discussion around the use of travel nurses, Mr. Speaker. Let me be perfectly clear how much we value the nurses who are working in the system. They're working day in and day out. I work alongside them, Mr. Speaker. I know they're doing the lion's share, a heavy lift, Mr. Speaker, and how much we do value the work that they're doing. That said, we were faced, the health authority was faced, with a dilemma, Mr. Speaker. Do we use travel nurses or do we shut down emergency departments? Do we shut down surgeries? Do we shut down dialysis units, Mr. Speaker? As a result, we're faced with the decision of how to do the least amount of harm and the best for the most people in the province, Mr. Speaker. It's an unfortunate circumstance. It's one that no one wants to find themselves in. In fact, I met with the president of the Nurses Union this morning to give her my reassurance that this government is working hard towards ending travel nurses.
The Honourable the Leader of the Official Opposition.
Speaker, the Premier admitted, and I'll use his words, sometimes things go off the rails. What we've seen reported in the news media certainly begs to the content of this particular contract. So I asked the Premier once again, did you authorize the signing of this contract that gives away air fryers and travel bonuses and all of those things related to this particular contract that have come out in this report?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly, I'm happy to address that. Simply no, Mr. Speaker. That was the health authority governed that contract, Mr. Speaker. But let me take an opportunity to discuss, Mr. Speaker. Sometimes in this House of Assembly, we're left with hypotheticals, with what would members opposite actually do? Well, I can tell you, when faced with a dilemma, the member opposite decided to take nurses away from the system, Mr. Speaker. Here we are as a government putting nursing resources into the system. The member opposite took away resources from the system, Mr. Speaker. Took away closed clinics, Mr. Speaker. Wanted to close clinics, Mr. Speaker. Closed clinics, which would lead to a backlog without the system. Wanted to make sure that they were taking nurses away, Mr. Speaker. We're not going to do that here in this side, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable the Leader of the Official Opposition.
I'm so glad the Premier brought it up again, because once again, the Liberal government elected in 2015 decided to cut health care. Not only the nurses in Black Tickle, but all our nurses in Western. Closed clinics in Central and took over 100 people out of Eastern Health. At the same time, cutting $50 million out of the health care budget. Perhaps if they had done that, listened to the nurses who are arguing about needing more nurses, not less. Maybe if they'd listened to the Nurses Union back in 2015, we wouldn't have to use as many travel nurses. So again, I ask the Premier, you're trying to convince us that this health authority turned around and entered into a contract for $36 million without the consent of the government?
The Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Again, the member opposite in his former role had a choice, Mr. Speaker. He could have defended nurses. He could have said that he was going to put more resources. He could have cut the executive staff. He could have come up with efficiencies. Instead, he decided to take...
Order, please. Order. The Honourable the Premier.
That said, Mr. Speaker, as the member opposite knows from his previous role, Mr. Speaker, he was CEO of a health authority, Mr. Speaker, presumably he knows that the Premier does not direct contracts within the authority, Mr. Speaker, nor does the department, Mr. Speaker. It was with the, it was a due diligence of the health authority itself, Mr. Speaker, that not only signed that contract but governed it, Mr. Speaker.
But I asked the minister again. He just mentioned the fact that he's asked the Controller General to investigate. The Controller General will investigate to make sure that invoices were approved, those type of things. What we really need, though, is the details of this contract. Who authorized what? How did we wind up paying $1.6 billion for meal allowances that were never paid out? This is where we need the Auditor General. So once again, I ask the minister, will he call in the Auditor General?
The Honourable, the Minister of Health and Community Services.
Mr. Speaker, it's funny how we change gears so quickly when he was the one that signed off on agency nurses as CEO of Lab Grenfell Health. We now get a different question about the Auditor General, but I'm happy to answer that as well. Mr. Speaker, we have asked the Controller General, who is independent, appointed on address of this House of Assembly, Mr. Speaker, to review this, just as I did when I was Minister of Finance and a similar issue arose with NLC, and we'd asked the Controller General. She reported then, or provided her report to the Auditor General, who then carried out her own assessment. It was then, it was also referred to JPS and to law officials, Mr. Speaker. So that is what we're doing, due diligence. The Controller General does not answer to the Minister or anybody else. They are
required. The Honourable the Leader of the Official Opposition.
One more question, Speaker. At the end of the day, I want to ask the Minister, this Minister or the former Health Minister, which one of them signed off on this contract that was awarded to this particular company? I asked the minister, did you sign off on the contract?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Community Services.
Mr. Speaker, the member knows the answer to that question because the member himself signed off on agency nurses as CEO of Lab Grenfell when Lab Grenfell was the only region in the province using agency nurses. Who signed off on them then? I asked the member. It was you, wasn't it?
The Honourable, the Leader of the Official Opposition.
Again, I simply asked the Minister, did you sign off on these contracts or didn't you? Yes or no?
The Honourable, the Minister of Health and Community Services.
Mr. Speaker, the answer is no. I did not sign off on these contracts. However, when you were CEO of Lab Grenfell, did you sign off on agency nurses? Because I believe the answer to that is yes.
So there you go, a little bit of the to and fro from the House of Assembly this afternoon, this time on the very hot topic of travel nurses. Still with that theme, RNU President Yvette Coffey met with the Premier and Health Minister for discussion on the topic of travel nurses. We'll hear what Yvette Coffey has to say when we come back after this. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Stay informed and have your say on the news of the day with your VOCM. Join Linda Swain weekday afternoons from 4 to 5 p.m. for an hour of talk and discussion with decision makers and listeners like you. News Talk on your VOCM.
And we are back. Well, Registered Nurses Union President Yvette Coffey met today with Premier Andrew Furey and Health Minister Tom Osborne to discuss ongoing concerns for nurses in the healthcare system. RNU members in the Western Zone were mandated to work overtime shifts last week after the contract with Canadian Health Labs for the provision of travel nurses came to an end. NL Health Services today confirmed that contract won't be renewed and the contract with CHL in the Central Zone comes to an end at the end of next month, although there is no word yet on whether or not that contract will be renewed. RNU President Yvette Coffey joins me now. Well, Yvette Coffey, a very busy day today, like every day, I'm sure. You met with the Premier and the Health Minister. How'd it go?
Well, we met with them this morning, and we're all in agreement that we want to eliminate the use of agency nurses in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. There's no denying we all want this. Government does have a responsibility to be prepared for this transition, because if they don't, it will negatively impact our patients, the delivery of our public health care, and of course it's going to impact negatively the nursing workforce and the profession. We never did say, just pull them out and that's it. We know it's going to take time. We have to transition. And what we've got to do is we've got to work on how we do that. And we have to work together to do that. And we actually brought some solutions with us this morning as well.
So what is the plan there? Because as we know, the contract has come to an end in the Western Zone, and by all accounts, it's not going to be re-awarded. So what's the situation there? We've got another contract coming to an end at the end of April. No word on where that's going just yet. You know, how are nurses going to fill that gap presently?
Well, some of the solutions that we brought forward, and I will say that someone from Nova Scotia actually shared with me the weekend an advertisement for Canadian Health Labs for nursing in Newfoundland and Labrador this summer. So I'm not privy to contract information, only what I'm hearing in the media. But one of the things that came out of our nursing think tank back in April of 2022 was paying retirees, paying their licensure fee, their college fee, so that they could come back into the workplace and help out. So that actually happened. It came out of the think tank, but that had an end date on it. So we did fly that to the Premier and the Health Minister this morning, and they were both very positive and agreeable to looking at it. Permit casual nurses to fill identified gaps versus agency nurses. We do have casual nurses here in the system looking to work some degree of hours and shifts. They can't because of family commitments and childcare issues work full-time or probably even commit to 600 hours of casual work, but they can work something, and it's still cheaper to pay that casual nurse a whole lot less than we would to an agency nurse. The other thing is double time for overtime, which we negotiated in our collective agreement for filling gaps in schedule. But at the present time, they're still waiting till the last minute to invoke that and do it, which for the system itself, if you know in advance that you are going to work overtime shifts and you're going to be paid for them appropriately, people were ready, willing, and able and did this last summer and signed up and filled gaps in schedules that was still cheaper than paying agency nurses. And, of course, our nursing students, and not just registered nursing students, but nurse practitioners, we need to offer them full-time jobs where possible and give them preferential consideration before we go to any private agencies. You've heard me talk about addressing the violence and the workplace injuries. Of course, our travel locum, which we have up in Labrador, we've even suggested let's use that to fill rural and remote hard-to-recruit areas as well on the island of Newfoundland. And, of course, flexible scheduling. That was one of the biggest things that we heard coming out of the nursing think tank and the nursing research. People want flexibility. They want to be able to manage their lives and manage their work lives versus their home lives.
How were your suggestions met?
Well, we have another meeting that we're going to schedule to talk about these suggestions. It all comes down to whether or not government wants to work with our members to make sure that the public health care system is the preferred employer of choice versus going out to these private agencies and spending millions and millions of dollars. We're looking forward to having more discussion with the minister and his department about some of the solutions we brought forward and also some of the concerns we brought forward today.
Yvette Coffey, I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda.
And Yvette Coffey, of course, is the president of the Registered Nurses Union. She met with Premier Andrew Furey and Health Minister Tom Osborne earlier today. Well, back to the House of Assembly for a moment. The House is open for the spring session, and there are a few faces missing this time around. Derek Bragg, of course, who passed away in January. David Brazel, who stepped down back in December, and Brian Warr, who stepped down just earlier this month. There's one new face in the House of Assembly this time around. Fred Hutton was just elected in the district of Conception Bay, East Belle Island. Well, tributes were paid on the opening day of the spring session of the House of Assembly for a fellow legislator who lost his battle with cancer in January. Derek Bragg was just 59 years old. Premier Andrew Furey, opposition leader Tony Wakeham, and NDP leader Jim Dinn all paid tribute to Bragg today.
Derek once famously declared, right out on those steps outside the Confederation Building, that he had more guts than brain. What he didn't realize is that it takes a lot of brains to have those guts.
The Honorable Leader of the Official Opposition.
He told of the car they built from two 10-speed bikes and a skidoo motor that went fine until the bicycles turned in two different directions. I'll be honest, he said, most call me nuts. But Derek was made for public service. We all saw it. He took on every challenge, worked his fingers to the bone, made friends out of strangers, and won the love and admiration of everyone who came to know him.
The Honorable Leader of the Third Party.
And I still remember the incident where he confronted angry fish harvesters. And when many would have turned and walked back into the building, Derek went down to speak to those fish harvesters and to engage in dialogue. And if anything else, that certainly earned my respect.
And really quite extraordinary when you think about the last session of the House of Assembly, of course. It had just come off the heels of a very contentious crab dispute. And back in the last spring session of the House of Assembly, Derek Bragg, even though he had this diagnosis, was front and center in that whole debate and trying to get the parties together to find a resolution to the incident. So his presence really missed in the House of Assembly there today, the first session. Sitting of the House since his very untimely passing, and our deepest condolences to all of his colleagues and, of course, his family. But it wasn't the only tribute made in the House of Assembly today. A moment of silence was also held in tribute to Brian Mulroney, who passed away last week at the age of 84. Here's some of what the Premier had to say.
Canada has lost a true patriot and statesman. Ever a friend to our province, and despite the political differences of affiliation, a friend to me as well, Mr. Speaker. Mulroney had a lasting impact on Newfoundland and Labrador through the original Atlantic Accord, shaping our offshore oil industry and setting a new horizon for Newfoundlanders and Labradorians.
And, of course, a state funeral is being planned for Brian Mulroney. It will be held in Montreal, but that is the extent of the detail that we know about that at this stage because the preparations have to be made to transport his body. He had been in Florida where he had taken a fall, and then his health declined even further just last week. So all of those arrangements have yet to be made. And, of course, a state funeral is not something that's held every day. So those preparations take some time, and it's all in consultation, of course, with Mulroney's family. And you've heard many of the tributes that have been coming in for the late Brian Mulroney over the last little while. If you have any thoughts on that, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and chime in if you like. Well, former U.S. President Donald Trump has scored a clear win at the Supreme Court in the United States with a unanimous ruling that dozens of states don't have the ability to bar him from the ballot. They were trying to keep Trump's name off their primary ballots under a rarely used constitutional provision that prohibits those who engaged in insurrection from holding office. The High Court didn't address the politically contentious issue of whether Trump violated the insurrection clause by sparking the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Quite shocking, actually. A lot of people watched that with great interest and shock, actually. Instead, it ruled that it is the U.S. Congress that gets to decide an election challenge under Section 3 and not the court. So once again, the U.S. Political process determined by the rulings of the courts. Very interesting to see how that's all unfolding. And Federal Budget Day has been set. It will be April 16th. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland expected to present an economic plan that's about jumpstarting construction of more homes, making life more affordable, and creating more good jobs. The government has introduced a slew of new measures aimed at increasing housing supply, and Housing Minister Sean Fraser is expected to unveil a plan soon that outlines how the Liberals intend to get more homes built and ease affordability. But the budget likely won't include big-ticket items if Freeland follows through with her promise of fiscal restraint. Well, that will be very interesting. traditionally, the budget here in Newfoundland and Labrador always comes after the federal budget, but that's been sort of changed in recent years, if you will. We've had the budget at different times, sometimes before, sometimes after, sometimes well after. And COVID is partly to blame for all of that, but also the timing of elections and all of those kinds of things. So it will remain to be seen when the budget will be called here in Newfoundland and Labrador. As I say, traditionally, it's after the federal budget, which, as we know, has been set for April 16th, but it will be interesting to see what comes out of this and what our finance minister, Siobhan Cody, has to announce in a fiscal plan in this province. And again, I would expect a lot of the same kinds of things, including housing measures and taking some kind of action to make life more affordable, because we are all feeling the pinch. Well, when we come back, is it a story or isn't it? And what becomes a story when you're not saying anything? We'll tell you more about what I'm getting on about. If you've been following curling, and I know a lot of people here in Newfoundland and Labrador have, Canadian lead Brianne Harris was ruled ineligible to compete in the Scotties Tournament of Hearts. And while that may not be fast-breaking news, it's what's not being said that is getting all the attention. We'll have a little chat about that when we come back after the break. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Nutrition, exercise, keeping the cold at bay. Whatever keeps you feeling great, the Wellness and Healthy Lifestyle Show on your VOCM.
Thanks a lot, Sarah and Greg. Well, as we mentioned before the break, is it a news story or isn't it? Lead Brianne Harris was ruled ineligible to compete in the Scotties Tournament of Hearts, and while that may not be fast-breaking news, it's what's not being said that is getting all of the attention. No one, from Harris herself to the Scotties to the curling Canada to her own team members, are talking about what happened or why. And every time a microphone gets put in anybody's face, I'm not at liberty to talk about this. And while it may not be anyone's business, the fact is that everyone involved is simply responding to questions with silence has garnered greater attention than if someone had simply come forward with a statement and explanation as to why no one can speak. Well, that's an age-old communications problem, isn't it? And nothing gets the media's and the general public's attention more than a refusal to speak. I wanted to know whether or not no comment is a smart communications strategy. Owner and principal consultant at Lupin Communications, Erin Curran, joins me now. Well, hello, Erin.
Hi, Linda. How are you today?
Great. So the media, and I'm sure communication specialists, are watching with great interest this whole scenario that's evolved now out of the Scotties. Brianne Harris has been deemed ineligible for the Scotties, one of the biggest curling events in the country, and nobody's talking. In fact, the mantra is, I can't talk about it. I'm not sanctioned to say anything. And this has created even greater interest. So from a communication standpoint, like, what is the kind of strategy here?
You know, I don't really know if there is much of a strategy at play here, which is what's making it kind of interesting. When I work with my clients, one of my first rules is to never say no comment and to have some kind of message ready, just to kind of, we call it kind of feeding the beast, like making sure that the media have what they need so that they don't look to other sources to help feed the narrative. So what seems to be happening here is that the people who should be speaking on this, whether, you know, they're willing to give all the information or just enough so that the story kind of goes away and doesn't become something more sensational, the people who are supposed to be doing that don't seem to be doing it. And it's becoming possibly a story that doesn't need to even exist. Typically, I would recommend that someone would release a statement or just give a quick message to say, we're looking into this, whether it's an active investigation or a personal reason. But it's, this whole no comment thing is really throwing kerosene on a fire that probably doesn't even need to be going.
So how typically do you handle a scenario where perhaps your client might say, you know what, I'm not talking about this? You know, how do you form a communication strategy around that?
I guess it depends on how much interest there is from local media or some of the opinion leaders in the communities. If it's kind of a quiet thing and we think it's something that could just die on the vine, I would say let's just let it go. But given that this is something that where there is a ton of interest and a ton of speculation being created, I would typically say, okay, we need to come up with what is our message? What are we willing to say? And how do we want to kind of make sure that we're adding to the narrative so there's truth and fact to it, so it doesn't become something it's not. So I would absolutely be recommending that, whether it be a statement or some spokesperson that's identified to speak to this, just to add a voice of credibility to the story, because I think reputation management is so important. And, you know, this woman's reputation is at stake, and the sport itself is suddenly having a scandalous story attached to it, which might not be necessary at all. So whenever there's something like this, it's kind of speak early and speak often, if that's possible.
I know it's probably not true of, you know, bigger things like the one we're talking about now, when you're talking about the Scotties and a sports organization and all of that kind of thing and the national scope. But, you know, I often tell people that I talk to as a person in the media, you know, like, you have to develop a certain level of trust and say, you know, give me the context here and I know how to deal with it. You know what I'm saying? Because we're all dealing with professionals. But I guess there's a lack of trust sometimes. And in some scenarios, I suppose, especially if it's larger or broader in scope, that trust isn't there.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of clients who have been a little bit mistrusting or nervous of media. And I'm always very, very quick to say that media are doing their job, and they have to do their job. And most times they're acting in the interest of the public good. So media don't want to report things that aren't factual or aren't true. So, you know, help them do their job. I think people get a little bit nervous, too, with all the things happening on social media, because suddenly everybody is a journalist. You know, citizen journalism has become a thing. And that makes people nervous. But from my perspective, all the more reason to have a voice as part of the story that's a credible voice from your organization or your side, shall we say, because anybody could start a rumor or start spreading false truths. And with social media and traditional media working at the same time, that can really snowball quite quickly.
You're absolutely right. Social media has changed how we do our job. Has it changed the way you do yours?
Oh, absolutely. I kind of try to treat social media as a place where we're doing kind of informal research all the time when it comes to coming up with strategy and clients, because it's a really good way to get a finger on the pulse of what people are thinking and saying. So it's a good place to watch for themes when it comes to comments and questions that are coming, or false truths or misinformation, and then finding strategic ways to use communication and messaging to rectify those truths and to answer questions that people are asking. You know, we can't control social media, but we can add to the narrative so that it stays as close to the truth as we can. You know, there's trolls everywhere and you can't control all that. But if you're being honest and transparent, authenticity goes a really, really long way. And it's so important to have a voice in the story as it's coming out. You can decide how far to go into that narrative, how much information to provide. But putting no voice in lets other people do it for you.
And the public are a lot smarter than I think some groups or organizations may give them credit for. You know, they know when they're being sold a bill of goods.
100%. And, you know, we all have networks. And again, coming back to social media, anybody can put some information on social media. So in this example, if Breanne Harris isn't speaking and her team isn't speaking, well, what if her neighbor decides to speak? Or what if someone who heard a rumor starts speaking or posts something on social media? And the next thing you know, the Globe and Mail might see a post on social media and follow up with that person and let that person have the credibility where it might not be valid. So because everyone becomes a journalist whenever they have a bit of information, thanks to social media, if you're not that credible voice, someone else will claim to be.
Erin Curran, fascinating conversation. I really appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem, Linda. I'm happy to help and anytime.
And of course, Erin Curran is the owner and principal consultant at Lupin Communications. Well, speaking of communications, a new high school is coming for Paradise, but the details are a bit scanty, to borrow a quote. When we come back, we'll hear from the minister and one of the most vocal proponents for the concept of a high school in Paradise when we come back after the break. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Your voice in Newfoundland and Labrador's biggest conversation.
If you want to know what's happening in your province, tune in to Open Line every day.
Have your say weekday morning starting at 9 a.m. on Open Line with Patty Daly on your VOCM.
Well, after years of lobbying, a new high school is in the works for Paradise, but families waiting to fill what they see as a major educational gap won't know the details for some time yet. Education Minister Krystalyn Howell made the announcement in Paradise this morning, flanked by Mayor Dan Bobbitt and MHA's Fred Hutton and Sarah Studley.
Just months ago, we announced the sites for new schools in Portugal Cove, St. Phillips, and Kenmount Terrace. And the contracts have been awarded for the planning and design of a new K-12 in the town of Cartwright in Labrador, as well as replacing the existing Henry Gordon Academy and an extension to the Dorset Collegiate, located in Pillies Island. We got a lot of things happening, a lot of infrastructure work happening in the department. And a thank you to my colleague, the Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure, for the collaborative process that we've been able to build on those special projects. We're moving forward with investing in school infrastructure to meet the needs of a dynamic province filled with students that need to be prepared to support a modern society. Today, I am happy to announce the provincial government's decision to build a new high school right here in the town of Paradise. And I know that many of you have conveyed your thoughts and opinions and concerns to the Department of Education, to myself as the minister, to your MHAs, and you've talked about the critical need for a high school to be built in this ever-expanding community of Paradise. We appreciate every single one of those concerns that you've brought forward, and we're taking action to address the needs of the community and the province. A very special thank you to the parent group who have been working on this for a long time, and they really are a model for appropriate, respectful, organized, and fact-based advocacy. It was never hard to have a meeting with you, and you were always respectful, so I certainly appreciate that and the attitudes and perspectives that you brought and your approach on this one. Government recognizes the growing population in Paradise and the Avalon as a whole. This infrastructure will meet the needs of our students in this area. A new high school will provide a modern learning environment for students in Paradise and the surrounding areas. Community spirit is already alive and well here in Paradise, and a new school will help foster a stronger sense of that spirit for the growing number of high school students here in this town while supporting positive student outcomes. With funding allocated through Budget 2024, planning for the next steps of the process, including site selection, design, and configuration, will begin in the coming months. Our government is committed to providing the best public education experience for students to ensure that they have the tools they need to move on to a post-secondary world. And I always say that I only wish every student in Newfoundland and Labrador could have the same educational experience that I had, and always will make that the goal of our department as we move forward. We know that a school can be the heartbeat of a community, and this new school will help strengthen the beat of an ever-growing, vibrant community here in Paradise. As a province, we've announced several measures to help support students and teachers and families. While this infrastructure is so valuable and so important, we also have additional measures that aren't solely bricks and mortar, but will undoubtedly impact the educational experiences here in Newfoundland and Labrador. our education accord, our teachers think tank, our school lunch program advancements, commitments to collaboration, along with the addition of new infrastructure, will help us achieve the goal of improving educational outcomes here in our province. There's no doubt that this new high school will play a key role in doing just that. It'll support students as they further their education and look forward to their future. Once again, I'm so pleased to be here today to be part of this important announcement, and I sure hope to meet and chat with some of the excited folks in the room at the end of the event today. Thank you.
So that was Education Minister Krista Lynn Howell at the Paradise Double Ice Complex this morning for that announcement on a high school coming for Paradise. No details yet. The funding will be announced in the upcoming budget. And this is the time of year when we start to hear some of those pre-budget type of announcements so that not everything that comes down in the budget is going to be a complete and utter surprise or shock, if you will. Well, Kayla Quinlan has been a very vocal proponent for the concept of a high school in Paradise. She spoke with reporters right after this morning's announcements.
It was a conversation with a group of parents who were just talking about where's the high school, and nobody really knew. So I decided then that I needed to call my MHA and get to the real root of the matter. And I spoke to MHA Paul Dinn, and he's like, you know, I've been really trying to get this on the go for about 10 years. And I thought that was a little bit unbelievable. So I was like, okay, so where are we now? And he's like, well, we really need the parents. And this day and age, social media is pretty strong, has a pretty strong voice. So I decided I'd make the group, Paradise Seems a High School. And it didn't need much convincing from anyone. Within like days and a couple weeks, we had thousands. From there, there was members that reached out to me, a mom actually, that her kids, she thought we were going to go to the high school. And she said, you know what, my kids aren't going to go. But here's all the facts that the reports that they got when they were back in the day. Sorry. I'm a little emotional now. It's so exciting. We got together, and she's like, you need a committee. So I was like, okay, because I'm a mom. I work. I'm busy. Like, it's not something that I could have sustained at all. Then we got a committee, and it was amazing. We've really formed this kind of a tight-knit group now. Everybody brought their set of skills. We had data collected. We had a media campaign. We just kind of presented the facts, and it was just undeniable. Once we gave the numbers, and I got to say, the government, both the PC party, the Liberal party, everybody, they were open and willing to talk to us. We showed up at the House of Assembly, and we just stayed together, and we just continued on the track, and that's why we're successful today, that we got the announcement that we wanted. But of course, now we want the facts. When's it going to happen?
So what sort of a difference will this make for children?
So we talked about this before. We have, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head right now, but we have many students that are being bused to Mount Pearl. Those schools in Mount Pearl are overflowing. Their students aren't able to maybe go to certain activities. My kids would have to go maybe an hour to drive. Now they can just go in their own community. There's also a sense of community that it evokes. Everybody is going to the same school, so the school that they start maybe kindergarten, the same students could intermediate and then throughout high school. It brings a lot of community involvement together as well. Then again, it affects school zoning, so the kids in CBS that our kids were also zoned for, their schools are going to be freed up now. So it's not just a school, and it's not just about if you have even kids in school, it's also bringing jobs. Like, it really is a community win for us today. I'm very thankful.
How do you feel after this announcement?
Like I said, I'm really excited. I'm also emotional because we've just kind of been quietly working about it. And I'm glad that everybody has recognized that there is, you know, we were respectful and we just presented the facts and the facts were heard. And it's going to be exciting times ahead. It's not, the work is not done, and I think we realize that, but this is certainly the first really positive step.
So are you continue your advocacy now to get the, you know, the timeline and to get the location of the new school from government?
Absolutely. So the committee, again, they're still planning on going to the House of Assembly this afternoon. We're wearing Paradise Blue. It's not party blue or anything like that. It's just Paradise Blue because we've had a lot of different people help us throughout this. Now it's like, you know, when is the school going to be built? What's it going to look like? Our voice is still going to be heard, and the group is still active. So it's just this is just this first step.
Do you think Paradise has waited too long for this high school? People have worked on this for a very long time. Has the wait been too long?
It has been long, for sure. Yeah, I think it was recognized that this need was there. I think we took upon ourselves now to just really make sure that it wasn't going to be overlooked again. The numbers, you couldn't deny the math.
You couldn't deny the math, says Kayla Quinlan, who has been a very vocal proponent for the concept of a high school in Paradise. She spoke with reporters after this morning's announcement at the Paradise Double Ice Complex this morning, including VOCM's Richard Duggan. Your thoughts on that? I would welcome you to give us a call or save it for tomorrow morning for the VOCM Your Mornings program. So stay tuned for that, and no doubt we'll get plenty of reactions. Well, Yemen's Houthi rebels say they didn't cut three Red Sea underwater cables providing internet and telecommunications around the world. As you know, Houthi rebels have been attacking ships in the region to try to pressure Israel to end its war on Hamas in the Gaza Strip. The sabotage of telecommunications lines affected 25% of the traffic flowing through the Red Sea and could further escalate the crisis in that region. Separately, the British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center reporting a new attack on a Liberian-flagged Israeli-affiliated container ship in the Gulf of Aden. So a very interesting set of circumstances happening there in the Red Sea, where it's already causing great concern worldwide, these attacks on ships, one of the busiest shipping channels in the entire world. Everything traveling between Europe and the Middle East and elsewhere passed through that very busy shipping channel. And we saw what happened when that big carrier got grounded. It held up shipments around the world for weeks. So a very serious scenario there. And now three underwater cables providing internet and telecommunications have been cut. Very concerning indeed. Another story that people have been watching very closely, and I'm not sure how many Newfoundlanders and Labradorians this story is on their radar, but it is very interesting indeed. Maine's state legislature says it has found flaws in a Canadian study on the use of the herbicide Agent Orange in the 1960s on a southern New Brunswick military base. And this has been a concern that has been voiced and raised for decades in that region. A report released in January by a legislature commission says the potential links between health problems and the use of Agent Orange at Canadian Forces Base Gagetown need to be reevaluated. It says a new investigation would help United States veterans access medical care if they had worked at the base where in 1966 and 1967 the American military tested defoliants such as Agent Orange. A 2005 study by the Defense Department and other Canadian government agencies found that herbicide levels used at the Gagetown base posed no risk to human health. But the Maine Commission says it gathered testimony that criticized the methods used to collect evidence in the Canadian study. Herbicides such as Agent Orange were used extensively in the 1960s by the American military during the Vietnam War to destroy crops of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, and to, I guess, get rid of the canopy so that they could see their movements underneath the jungle canopy. The U.S. Veterans Affairs Department has recognized certain cancers are associated with exposure to those chemicals, which were tested at CFB Gagetown in 1966 and 1967. And once again, people have been raising concerns about their use, the use of Agent Orange in that area for many decades now. Well, that is it for us for today on VOCM News Talk. We'll be back tomorrow. Do join us then. We'll continue the conversation, of course, in your VOCM mornings tomorrow morning, as well as get all the latest news now out of the legislature and elsewhere in major news package now coming up at 5 with Sarah Strickland. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great evening. Bye-bye for now.